I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A large number of working-age adults are operating in the labor force without any relevant college credentials. What does that mean for employers seeking greater numbers of skilled workers? Today, a conversation about workforce development in Kansas and Missouri. We'll ask the University of Kansas Chancellor how higher education can meet the demand and do it at an affordable price for students. Then, many cities and towns have a Chamber of Commerce, but Kansas City has several. The presidents of the Asian and Hispanic Chambers join us to explain the needs of their business communities and to detail what they offer their members. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. One big buzz term in Topeka and Jefferson City this session is workforce development. It refers to this idea of training workers for the jobs of tomorrow. Turns out that in Kansas and Missouri, the challenge is enormous. The Kansas Board of Regents, for instance, has said that in Kansas alone, there are more than 700,000 working-age adults with no meaningful post-secondary credential. Doug Girard, the chancellor of the University of Kansas, has proposed strategies for how to deal with this issue. And he joins me here in the studio. Chancellor, nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
700,000 working-age adults with no meaningful post-secondary credential. Should I be surprised the number is that large?
You know, I think it's fair to be surprised about that, and certainly concerning when you figure that the current data would suggest at least two-thirds of jobs that are out there require some form of higher education after high school.
Yeah. You know, you wrote a column about this issue in the Star a few weeks ago, and you were pretty blunt about what this means for the metro. You wrote this, Chancellor: unless we grow the pool of skilled workers, our companies will stall or relocate to regions with more talent. Are we seeing some of this already?
You know, I think we're seeing a lot more intentionality about trying to address these issues as this has become a concern for everybody. Through efforts like the Casey Rising effort, which is a civically oriented effort to grow the economy, we learned that workforce was a very big problem across all sectors of the economy in the Kansas City metropolitan area in particular. And so there are a number of initiatives going on trying to address those issues, but it certainly is reaching an acute point when you figure we have about 3% unemployment, the lowest in 50 years, and we're seeing across America fewer students enrolled in higher education, largely due to demographic changes.
What are you hearing from businesses and industry in terms of what they require for their workforces? Are they ringing your phone and telling you what they need?
They are, but it's a bit problematic in that everybody needs something a little bit different. And so we have been working with the business community to help put some definition around things like soft skills. That's something that we hear very commonly from employers. And the Mid-America Regional Council did a very nice big effort over about a year to try and collate that into what are those soft skills that we need to be training our students with.
And Soft skills are things like what? What are you talking about?
You know, working in teams, being able to write coherently in a presentation, being able to give a presentation, and frankly, even simple things like showing up to work on time.
Yeah. You know, bottom line, you wrote in that column in the newspaper, regions that produce and retain talent will grow. Regions without talent will decline. You think it's that cut and dried?
I really do at this point, because this is a national trend. This is not just our trend. When we're seeing fewer students going into higher education, that's been true every year for the last decade in America, and that's projected to continue for the next decade. And yet we have our lowest unemployment we've had in 50 years. When you put those two things together, combined with the fact that while 70% of the or 60% of the jobs out there require some higher education, the jobs created since the recession, 13 million jobs created since the recession, 70% of those new jobs required a bachelor's degree or more. That's a game changer when you think about it. We're seeing a shift in the workforce in America, and we need to be much more in tune with that and figure out creative ways to make sure our students are finding their way through that to have those jobs.
And that's why you wrote that the demand for college graduates has never been greater. That's what you're seeing out
there. It's absolutely true.
you know. At the same time, we're seeing these demands for college graduates. We're also seeing this slippage in enrollment that you mentioned. Across the country, just to reiterate here, college enrollment has declined for 10 straight years, as the chancellor just said. It's expected to decline further in the next decade. KCUR has reported on the slowed growth in the number of Kansans earning a college degree. You mentioned demographics are causing that. What do you mean?
Well, some of that is just sheer numbers of high school graduates. And this is a low birth rate 18 years ago is now playing out into the numbers of students that are in at high school age. But you also have to factor into it, we have more first-generation students in our demographic, and they don't attend higher education at the same rate as others, at least not without a lot of effort. So we need to be very intentional about this.
So we need to change the trend. How is KU going to address that?
You know, I think we've all tried to be very creative about this. I'll just give a couple examples here in the Kansas City metro area. Working with Dave Cook, our vice chancellor down at the Edwards campus, we've created the Degree in 3 program. So that's a program working with our school districts and Johnson County Community College, Metropolitan Community College, and Kansas City, Kansas Community College to allow students to finish 1 year of college in high school, 1 year at the community college, 2 years at Edwards, and they're out. So they get their bachelor's degree in 3 years at a much lower cost than alternatives.
How much lower? What kind of savings are you talking about?
Well, you're talking about really only 2 years of four-year institution tuition, and then 1 year at junior college. And so it really not only carves out an entire year, but it also gets two of those years at a very low cost.
I was going to say the elephant in the room here, and as you know, I teach up the hill here at UMKC, the rising cost of college education, it's pricing a lot of kids out of that market. That's a big concern.
It is a major concern for us, and we've seen that across America, but certainly very significantly so in Kansas. You know, if you go back even 10 or 15 years, you know, the state was funding 60% of the cost of education. The students and families were doing 40%. We've now seen an inversion of those ratios. And
wow.
That's driven cost up significantly in tuition for those kids and those families. And that's pushing student debt as well, which is a whole other conversation we could spend an hour on, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And we've worked very hard on that by raising money for scholarships. And so I'm happy to report that 50% of our students finish with no debt.
50%?
50%.
That'll surprise people listening.
That probably will. But 50% on average that do have debt have about $28,000 of debt. Now, that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a lot of money in terms of investment when the data would show that that college degree is going to create $1 million over the course of your lifetime of additional earnings.
Mm-hmm.
And as we just talked about, is becoming sort of the dance card, if you will, into our current economy.
I think, you know, the image, the sense out in society writ large is that college is just so expensive. There's a narrative out there that needs to be overcome. So many people look at that and think, I can't afford college. I've got to go to Plan B here.
Yeah, I think that's true. And yet there are so many programs from the federal programs to scholarships, which is true at most of our universities. We have significant scholarship dollars to be able to apply to help those students get through work study programs. So working while you're a student, which most of us had to do when we went through college.
Yeah.
You know, with all that, you can make it a more manageable investment. You just have to be thoughtful and careful about it and be careful about what you borrow.
Yeah. Can all students do that?
Can all students
do work study and,
yes.
and take advantage of those programs?
You know, we have almost 3,500 student employees at the University of Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
So we try and create as many of those opportunities as we can.
You know, in fairness, state funding is a big factor here, and you've alluded to it here, Chancellor. In Kansas, annual state funding for KU has declined $28 million since 2008. That's not even accounting for inflation. Why is that? I mean, what's happened here? Because in my own career as a reporter, I've seen higher education go from something of a sacred cow in the late 80s and 90s to a cow that lawmakers like to kick these days.
Yeah, you know, clearly in 2008 and 9 with the Great Recession, we all saw, I mean, across the country saw a major dip in funding because the tax dollars just weren't there for all state agencies. The big difference here is we have not recovered from that. And whereas coming out of the recession, other states have started to reinvest once again, really in Kansas, we have not done that. And in fact, we're number 47 out of the 50 states in terms of what we've done with higher education funding since the recession. And so
47th out of 50.
Out of 50. And that's not where you want to be. Missouri's in the mid-30s. They're not a whole lot better, but they are better. Mm-hmm. In that there's been some recovery of higher education funding, but there just really has not been recovery of higher education funding in the last decade since the recession. And to put an accent on that, you mentioned KU's down $28 million. If you put just a CPI inflation index on that, that's over $70 million a year.
Mm-hmm. How does that impact your campus? What changes have had to result because of all that?
Well, first and foremost, what those state dollars go towards are core operations and offsetting educational expenses. There's no other revenue stream for that other than tuition and fees for that. We have research dollars, but those fund research. We have contract dollars, but those fund the work that we do for those contracts. The only way we can fund education is the state component and the tuition component. So that's clearly driven our tuition up very significantly over that period of time. And you can't do that indefinitely. And so we are now at a point of doing major budget reductions at the Lawrence campus right now. We're carving $20 million out of our current year's budget, and we're designing a new budget model to just recognize our current environment because we just can't keep pushing these expenses onto the students.
And when parents complain then about higher tuition, one big factor then is lack of state support.
No question.
Yeah. So what's the attitude in the legislature this year? What are you seeing and what are you hearing from lawmakers in terms of reversing the trend?
You know, I'm pleased to report that we spent a lot of time in the State House this year, and we have a lot of allies there that are really starting to recognize the import of this issue in relationship to the Kansas economy. And I'm certainly sensing a desire to help correct this problem offset with the challenges of the current state budget. Mm-hmm. And so while at least there's a desire to help us figure out how to get more funding into higher education, there's certainly the constraints of really some difficult budget issues that they have to deal with.
You know, I'm visiting with KU Chancellor Doug Girard. You know, I'm wondering about asking businesses and employers to defray the cost of a student's education, you know, either by paying tuition in return for, you know, a commitment they'll work in the business for a number of years, or promising to assist the students with paying off their debt if they become employees. Is that become sort of part and parcel of the employment experience in Kansas yet?
You know, I think we're just starting to see that. The businesses are starting to, in those really, really high demand areas, and I would say computer sciences, cybersecurity being one that I'm aware of, that businesses are actually reaching in and contacting students when they're sophomores and juniors and trying to create a relationship there and some funding there to in exchange for agreeing to come work for a company. And yeah. So I think companies are having to get much more aggressive and inventive about how they're identifying their future workforce.
You know, I'm wondering, too, about the possibility, if you've reached the point financially, Chancellor, about even eliminating classes not related to a student's career track. You know, some might say it's time to let go of the goal of sending a well-rounded person into the world. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say, given that what I hear is that we need to make sure we focus on the soft skills, I think that's where those two overlap, right? I mean, what a well-rounded person is the person that has those soft skills. And so we may need to be perhaps more intentional about how we do that. And yet, I think eliminating a lot of those basic courses that give you the foundation for any direction is important. It's also important because we know people are going to have to be lifelong learners. The current graduate is going to change careers at least 7 times over the course of their lifetime, their professional lifetime.
7 times.
7 times.
That's not the way it used to be.
Some say up to 11 times. And that's because of the rapid change in technologies. They're going to be doing jobs in 10 or 15 years that don't even exist today. So we have to prepare them to have the skills, the well-rounded skills, to be able to continue that lifelong learning even after they leave. And then we actually have to provide those tools for them. And it's not going to be get a job until you no longer have that job because everything changed and then you go back to school, it's going to be keeping those skills up as you go along. And it's amazing to think about.
So you're talking about learning how to write, learning how to think critically, all those basic things that colleges talk about, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's go back to the strategies that you're proposing to improve the training of the workers of tomorrow. One thing you want to do is increase collaboration between employers and higher education. Explain that one to us.
You know, I think that's multifaceted. It's everything from having employers help us tell the story to our legislators and help the legislature understand how important it is to our employers that they help.
Seeing that engagement from the business community yet.
We're seeing it really ramp up just in the last couple of years with the chambers becoming much more engaged, with business leaders being willing to come over and testify as they're starting to recognize that we all are in this together. Mm-hmm. And that's one area. Another is really when we talk about those soft skills, we know that most of those are best learned actually on the job. So creating those experiential learning opportunities, those internships, those opportunities to embed into a business and actually see what it means to work in that environment, mm-hmm. not only improves the student's vision of where they're headed, but it gives them that opportunity to work in that environment and develop some of those skills. So we have to create, you know, that there are fields that we do that extensively in, but we don't do it broadly across the whole campus, and we really should, and we need partners to be able to do that.
Strategy two, you point to, and we've talked about this a little, but you want the state to pitch in more for higher education. That means lobbying lawmakers to get on the stick, as far as you're concerned, when it comes to colleges and universities.
And it has to be more than just me and my counterparts being in the State House. They know what we're going to say when we show up. But when a business leader comes, when a company CEO comes, when a chamber comes and says, look, this is critically important to us and our economy, you're really challenging us here by not helping us out. That's much more impactful than when I say those words.
Doug Girard is my guest, the Chancellor of the University of Kansas. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You want to better market the Kansas City region as well, Chancellor. What's your thinking there?
You know, I had the wonderful opportunity to be involved with that KC Rising initiative, was one of the initial co-chairs of that. And as we went through those workforce development conversations, there became a conversation around going outside the metropolitan area and recruiting, really selling Kansas City as a place, which is so important to this generation, to go to other communities and do that. And when I took, you know, 18 months ago, went to Lawrence, I began to realize that actually the people in Lawrence don't know what's going on at Kansas City. The students in Lawrence, they, you know, we were 40% out of state as well. Those kids, mm-hmm. really, their perception is the airport. So we need to do a better job of letting our own students know what the wonderful opportunities are in this marketplace and in this economy. You know, we do a pretty good job of our 40% out of state students. 25% of them stay here when mm-hmm. they graduate. Yeah. That's without a lot of intentionality. So I think we could be a net importer of talent if we do a better job, a better pipeline of not only selling Kansas City, but connecting them to our employers.
You know, what are some of the skills that you're hearing maybe more often from employers than others? Are there certain things that stand out that you know that KU needs to address?
Well, first of all, we know that we have a significant mismatch in our community, and that about 60% of the jobs in this market require a STEM degree, and yet 60% of our students are not in STEM fields. And so we've got a mishmash there that we really need to correct. But that's a correction that we need to start in grade school, middle school, and high school.
I was going to say, how do you even attempt that task?
You have to obviously catch them much earlier. But a lot of it's actually just letting people really know what those opportunities are, that they're out there, and what those many different fields are. They're not all just engineering. There's many fields and STEM fields out there. And so helping people realize that and showing them their opportunities. So we're trying to get into the schools. We're trying to bring kids on campus to demonstrate those and help them see what that opportunity is. So we know we have a match there that we need to really work on for this local economy.
Is that a countrywide issue, this lack of interest in STEM fields by a lot of our students?
It is, but it's also very regional. I mean, if you go to the Bay Area or you go to Boston, that's not a problem.
But out here it is.
Out here it is. It's just people don't see the same opportunities, I think. It's just it's not as much in the perception of the students.
You know, Governor Mike Parson has made workforce development one of his two top issues this year. To what extent are officials from Kansas and Missouri working together on this? Because they obviously bracket the Kansas City area.
I don't know that there is a lot of cross-state work going on in this area right now. I mean, we're trying to work in a number of different areas, such as, you know, solving the border war and some other issues that, would be very impactful for our regional economy. But to be fair, other than our institutions actually are working together, but I think at the state level and leadership level, I'm not aware of any initiatives.
And maybe that needs to change.
That could certainly be helpful. And of course, we sit right in the crossroads of that, so certainly from a Kansas City perspective, that would be very helpful.
You know, my sense from working in higher ed for a few years now is that, you know, turning the ship of state, you know, in this case, institutions as large as KU or UMKC and adjusting to new demands is extraordinarily difficult. Am I right about that? And how are you going about this over in Lawrence?
You're right. We're large, storied institutions, which means we have lots of tradition, and that's wonderful in a lot of ways. But we know that our marketplace is changing very quickly, and so from a KU perspective, you know, we've got lots of efforts going on in various departments. But really, our Edwards campus has really been our skunk works, if you will, of our opportunity to try and stand something up very quickly, like a coding boot camp that we've been able to stand up over there direct demand from our employers. And, we can get those running pretty quickly on that campus. We can also wind them down pretty quickly if they're not panning out. And so we really have that as a platform. Obviously, it's here in the metro area and can react and interacts much more so with the local businesses. And then as we learn those things, we can translate them more broadly across the campus.
Do you think a lot of people are even aware of the Edwards campus and the opportunities it offers? Maybe you should take a minute and tell people about it.
Yeah, so that's we'll be celebrating the 25th anniversary, actually, of the Edwards campus this year. And that's a branch campus of KU, and it's a campus designed much more towards the working student. So 75% of the students there are working, and about half of them working full-time. Mm-hmm. And it's also got a heavy graduate focus, so master's degrees and other additional degrees for those working professionals. But actually, about half of it's undergraduate now as well, and we've been really growing the programs largely in response to the market. To address market needs on that campus. And so it's not a residential campus. The students are commuters for the most part. And as I said, most of them are employed, but has wonderful online opportunities as well.
That's interesting. I can't help but ask, this is a big week for college basketball, KU in the hunt here for the 14th or 15th straight
big 15th straight, if we can pull it off.
It's not looking really good this week as you enter the week. How important is the success of that team to enrollment and other good things that happen over at KU?
You know, our athletics programs serve so many purposes. Certainly, they get us on national television on a regular basis, keeps us very well connected to our alumni around the world. And I hear that as I travel. I was in Dallas this last weekend. It's what keeps – that's how they can stay in touch with us no matter where they live. And it's been so important. But probably the best example on the enrollment side was in 2009, after our 2008 year of both winning a national basketball championship but also winning an Orange Bowl, we saw our highest enrollment the next year in the history of the university.
No kidding.
So there's very definitely a direct correlation. That's not unique to KU. You see that across the country.
Yeah.
So it does play a very important role in the success of who we are as a university.
You know, KU has had its struggles this year with the NCAA and investigations. I'm just wondering, has the time come in your mind for college athletes like the big basketball players at KU to be paid?
You know, that's a deep, complicated question right there.
Or not.
Well, I think we need to maybe do a better job of getting those athletes that are ready to go pro to go pro and really focus on the more amateur athletes. As you know, 98% of NCAA student athletes will not be in the pros. And really the issue is around those 2%. And I do think we need to figure that piece out.
And isn't there a proposal before the NBA right now to accept athletes as young as 18 down from 19? And that would change college basketball enormously, wouldn't it?
It would. And that was one of the recommendations coming out of the Rice committee that was making
kind of Lisa Rice, the former Secretary
correct,
of State.
Correct. And that was one of the strong recommendations is to try and move away from the one and done, which is really an NBA-driven event. It's not an NCAA-driven event. So it would require the NBA to change how they do their recruiting.
Do you support that idea?
I do.
Yeah, the time has come for that, too.
Yeah, I really think so.
Hey, how much criticism, how much of a comment do you get about how much you pay Coach Bill Self and the other coaches at KU? What kind of feedback do you get about that?
You know, always it's part of the conversation when you're having difficult budget issues on campus.
I was going to say.
There's no question.
Those two things get...
You know, I'm happy to say that the university supports athletics to a very small amount. I think currently we're at about $1.5 million a year that the university supports athletics for 500 student athletes. That number's hopefully going to shrink over the years. So they largely self-fund themselves, which we're grateful for. That's not true at a lot of places. That being said, it's an expensive market. Marketplace. It's just what the marketplace is.
Yeah. And that's something you just have to face with your people over and over again.
It is.
Remind us again what you've seen in terms of enrollment at KU going back 4 or 5 years. What is the trend right now?
You know, we've had 5 consecutive years of overall enrollment growth. I won't say it's a lot. I mean, it's in some years it's been in the dozens. And our freshman class has grown 4 out of the last 5 years. And that's a real victory in this current marketplace. So,
yeah. So
we're pleased with that, but not taking that for granted. And that's been true because of tremendous efforts on our enrollment staff and admission staff who've really gotten aggressive. And we've been able to do better on the scholarship side as well, thanks to our donors.
But why do you think enrollment is up? What's your best theory on that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we also, a number of years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, we raised our admission standards. We raised our GPA and test score requirements to get into KU for fear of that. The fear was we might see a drop in enrollment. But what we knew was students that came in below those did not succeed at a very high rate at all. And it really wasn't fair to them. What we've actually seen, as I mentioned, is a slow enrollment growth, but the most academically talented class we've ever had. And the highest retention rates that we've ever had. So
I
think we're getting prepared students, and we're being able to provide them an outstanding experience, and I believe that's why it continues to grow.
Let's go to Bob from Lawrence. Bob, you're on with the Chancellor. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Doug, for all the work you're doing. My question is, what is KU the status of KU's innovation in the way of competency-based accreditation? I know this was a model that had been discussed at the Edwards campus for a number of programs, and I was just wondering what the latest is on that. I know that one of the problems that KU has is we are somewhat of a aircraft carrier, and we're dealing with a lot of PT boats in our local market. So,
explain, if you would, Chancellor, what is competency-based education?
Bob, if I'm understanding you correctly, and thanks for calling in, it's really giving credit based on somebody's demonstration of mastery as opposed to completing a number of hours or number of projects, but actually doing it based on your competence level. And,
right. And
theoretically, you can move somebody through. Well, some people will move through faster that way. Some might actually move through a little bit slower, but having that flexibility. And it's right in there with the same conversation around credit for prior experience. And so I'll give an example of that as we have a program working with U.S. military in healthcare. So they have a respiratory training program there that's not accredited, but actually gives tremendous skills to those students. We can give them credit for that in our program so that they don't have to repeat that to continue to do that on. And those are two sort of areas that I think are ripe for further exploration. We're having those conversations at the Board of Regents.
So you don't do that yet at KU?
We are doing the military prior experience one. That's our first one that I'm aware of.
Okay.
And looking at other places where we can do similar type things. And back to Bob's point on competency-based, at the moment, I don't think we have a lot of that going on right now, Bob. Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. We'll leave our conversation there. I want to thank the Chancellor of the University of Kansas, Doug Girard, for coming in and talking to us about workforce development. And sure, appreciate your time, Chancellor. Good luck over there, okay?
It's great to be here, Steve.
You
thanks
bet.
So much
thanks
for
very
the opportunity.
Much. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about ethnic chambers of commerce in the Kansas City area. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week on the show, we learned how digital reading can inhibit our ability to reason and empathize. Hear all about it at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, can you recall enough American history to pass the U.S. citizenship exam? Studies say more than half of us wouldn't pass. Test your knowledge tomorrow on KCUR's Up-to-Date. Well, the Greater Kansas City Chamber of Commerce is the biggest business organization in the metro. You may not know that other chambers exist, too, including the Asian American Chamber of Commerce of Kansas City and the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce of Greater Kansas City. Now a conversation about those chambers, what they do, why they're needed, and where they're headed. With us, Fong Shen is president of the Asian American Chamber of Commerce of Kansas City. Nice to have you, Fong. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Carlos Gomez is president of the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce of Greater Kansas City. Carlos, welcome to you, too.
Good morning.
Well, let's get right into this, Carlos. Why do you guys exist? I mean, why is there a need for an Hispanic chamber and an Asian American chamber when the Greater Kansas City Chamber exists out there?
Well, you know, Steve, in a perfect world, there shouldn't be any minority chambers. But unfortunately, we don't live in a perfect world.
Not yet, anyway. Maybe next year, right?
We're striving for that.
Yeah.
You know, our chamber was started 42 years ago, back in 1977.
Wow.
And we are the birth chamber of the United States Hispanic Chamber that's in Washington, D.C. So back in the 70s, affirmative action had just passed. There was federal contracting for minorities. And so a group of Hispanic leaders headed by Hector Barreto saw a need. And
he was the founder, if you will.
He was.
Of both, the national chamber based here in Kansas City, at least initially.
Yes, actually, yeah. Both the local and the national.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw a need that Hispanics, we would be left out of the process. So they started the Hispanic Chamber of Greater Kansas City to help fill that void of education. How do you get into federal contracting? And, you know, just the education part, because there's a lot of learning curve when you start getting into these programs.
So there was a void there that he and others saw that needed to be filled.
Yes. And at no fault to the city chambers. That's not their lane. The minority chambers, we understand how minority contracting, corporate America, they have minority women, veteran goals. And that's where we, the Asian Chamber, the Heartland Black Chamber, we understand how all those programs work, and we help minority businesses build capacity so that they can do business with corporate America and the government.
You know, Fong, as Carlos is talking, you're nodding your head. This all resonates with you, it sounds like.
Absolutely. I mean, This is the first time I hear Carlos saying that, but I'm surprised and not surprised to hearing a lot of similarity. Our chamber was founded about 20 years ago in 1998, but sharing sort of the similar reason for starting. It was founded by two local Asian American entrepreneurs when they saw there's a need to first give a voice of the Asian business owners, but as well as to serve some of the special needs, such as different economic opportunities, providing different resources and education.
And minority contracting being a big one of those,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yes, minority contracting, I think, is definitely one of the important considerations. I will say, though, after 20 years now, because the chamber has grown tremendously, and we're kind of starting to expand things, and in that process, we're also finding things that we didn't think about before. So today, if you compare, you know, the Asian Chamber or the Hispanic Chamber, which I view them sort of a more specialty or niche chamber compared to general chamber of Kansas City, I just think they serve different needs. I think the Greater Kansas City Chamber of Commerce, which does a fantastic job, you know, for example, many corporations are members to both because they offer.
I was going to say, your members do belong to both.
Yeah, exactly. For example, my own firm, you know, professionally, I'm an attorney, and my own firm, Hush Blackwell, will be a member to both because they offer completely different things. I view the Greater Kansas City Chamber of more focused on kind of broader business community, more general interest, but the Asian Chamber or Hispanic Chamber will be more to a targeted audience. You know, there's certain specialized needs of our members which are better served by a niche or specialty chamber. Some of our programs will be more focusing on things that are, you know, are of a special interest or
That's
more need for our chamber.
Carlos, I'm just curious, to what extent is the Hispanic chamber growing as the years pass?
Tremendously. First of all, the Hispanic...
That's interesting to me. Yeah.
Well, the Hispanic... These are the SBA numbers. And the last 3 years in Missouri, Hispanic small business growth has grown at a 48% growth rate each year.
No kidding.
In Kansas, it's a 76% growth rate each year for the last 3 years. Now, with that, though, the majority of that growth is an immigrant business growth. So a lot of the immigrants don't quite know what a chamber is or where they came from. The chamber may have been affiliated with the government. So, you know, they have different fears about that. So, you know, there's an education piece even within our own community of what does a chamber do.
To what extent do you have members or new business owners coming to you saying, you know, I want to start a business, or I've just started one and I'm confused about how to proceed, because their mom and pop operations perhaps is trying to get a foothold in the market wherever it is in Kansas?
Well, definitely. So we actually offer a free class, and it's in Spanish. And we help individuals do all their paperwork. So on average, 10 to 12 people a month, we help get into business with from their LLC, S-Corp, federal tax ID, sales tax ID, registration with either Secretary of State of either state. And we do that as a community service. But this is a really interesting statistic. During the down economy of 2009 and 12, small business growth only grew at 3%. That was non-minority. Minority small business growth grew at a 38% growth rate.
That's
Asian, Hispanic, African American, and women. The women would be considered a diverse business.
And that's happening because of what? The changing demographics of this country? Is it that simple, Carlos, or is it something else?
I would say it's a combination of two things. The country is the demographics. We are a changing nation. Most immigrants coming to this country, business is a natural thing to do, and being an entrepreneur.
Why?
Because where you come from, whatever skill set you had, that's how you survive. If I'm a carpenter, if I know how to work with my hands, if I know how to cook, that's how you survive. And when you come to this country, it's just a natural. If you look around the metro, regardless of what nationality, immigrants tend to be more entrepreneurial.
And you're seeing the same thing in the Asian American community?
Yes. Since the foundation, at the very beginning, it was more a steady growth. But I would say, at least, especially during the last 10 years, we have seen tremendous growth of the chamber. Actually, in a couple of aspects, maybe where we didn't quite expect. For example, I concur with a lot of what Carlos described, you know,
right.
'Cause a lot of the Asian immigrants, they kind of came here with entrepreneur spirit anyway. Because their family may have owned a small business back to home country. That's their skill set. But one area, at least when I joined the chamber, I didn't quite realize where we play a big role or a lot of the tremendous growth is actually a lot of our members are not necessarily Asian-owned businesses. A significant portion is, and that's our most foundation. But I think you're going to see a lot of familiar names and some of the bigger organization or what you would consider non-minority-owned business. They are actually very active participants of our chamber.
Because some of their new staff members are Asian American.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's because of changing demographic, because even though they might not be Asian owned, but there is a tremendous need to recruit and retain diverse talents, especially in Kansas City, a growing business community. And in certain sector, for example, technology driven, and there are certain diverse workforce that's very crucial for these
right.
businesses. So you see a very active participation with those organizations.
You know, Fong, I'm just curious, to what extent does your chamber do what Carlos's chamber does once a month, offering programs for entrepreneurs to help them get businesses established? Is that part of what you do as well?
Absolutely. We have monthly programs, so year-round. Mm-hmm. Try to serve different needs. Some of them are more networking oriented. Some of them are more resource or education. For example, teaching you or helping you how to start a business, or some specialized area that's more relevant to small businesses, such as how to finance a small businesses, or when the tax law change, how does that impact small businesses? And then we also have other events helping organizations to retain or hire talents. For example, you know, next week we actually have an event that's a job fair, and you're going to see participants from large corporations from all over town, but they are interested in hiring diverse talents.
That's interesting.
So we have kind of we design a program because as we grow, we learn from our members what they want, what they need. So I would say you almost see the Asian Chamber, I view it as almost a marketplace where you want to see the Asian-owned businesses and Asian talents are interacting with the greater business community. So it definitely started with serving the Asian-owned business, but I think it's grown larger than that.
You know, Carlos, I'm just curious. Do you categorize the types of businesses that your members own and operate? I mean, is there? Can you walk through what the most popular types of businesses are?
We do. Right now, for us, I can tell you the number one is construction or construction-related.
Well, that's interesting. I would not have guessed that either.
The economy is up. And here's the thing. For the Hispanic community, 24% of the Hispanic community as a career is in construction or construction related.
Oh, that's interesting.
So almost 1/4.
Yeah.
So it would be natural that if I've been working for somebody for 10 years, 20 years, and now I want to open up my own business, I already know how to do it. I know how to do the construction side, but now I need to learn how to do the back end, the invoicing, the
and those are
the
two
bidding.
Two wildly different skill sets, right?
Completely.
And you can't underestimate one or the other.
Yes,
yeah.
And construction's one of the most difficult businesses to get into. It's one of the few businesses where a contract can put you out of business, mm-hmm. believe it or not, because you have to really scale your growth. But here's what's really unique, I think, about the diverse chambers. We encourage our members to join other mainstream city chambers. It's all about widening circles. And when it comes to business, it's about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't, if we have a member in Olathe, we encourage them to join the Olathe Chamber of Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they not want to expand their business circles to more resources, more connection that will only bring positive things to a small business?
And they do that, I imagine.
They do. Now, there is some... I think some chambers are more open to diversity than others.
Mm-hmm.
Olathe Chamber is an incredible chamber, by the way. We work very closely with them.
Mm-hmm.
They're obviously a changing demographic area of Kansas City, and
yeah.
they get it.
Yeah.
There's some others where diversity is new. You have to remember these city chambers started when the city was founded. So you have chambers that have been there for 100 years, 120 years. So the culture for change is not as easy to move.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about ethnic chambers of commerce in the Kansas City area. We're visiting with Fong Shen, who's president of the Asian American Chamber of Commerce, Carlos Gomez, president of the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. You know, Fong, I can't help but ask, how has the business climate changed during President Trump's tenure in terms of how your own members see things and are impacted by what's happening?
That's a great question, because as I kind of mentioned, we are a specialty chamber, so certain issues, certain policy will impact the constituents of our chamber greater than others.
Mm-hmm.
And the trade policy, because many of our members are truly American-owned business, has mm-hmm. nothing to do with international trade. But as you can imagine, naturally, because a lot of our members are immigrants-owned business, so naturally they will have some business relating to international trade. So we actually make sure we think about what events or what education we can put on to help our members to stay up to date with what's happening and how trade policy might impact their businesses and what are the strategies. So
mm-hmm.
I will say most of our members, because they are very resilient, so I think there's definitely an impact, and we are doing things to help them to stay current on what's happening
mm-hmm.
and coming up with just different strategies, and they are very resilient in adjusting.
They've got to be resilient, right?
Yes.
That's the name. Hey, Carlos, I can't help but ask, trade policy obviously being a big factor. Also, immigration policy, I'm sure, is talked about a lot in your circles.
Yes. I will actually be flying to Washington, D.C. tonight. 13 members are joining. We go to D.C. every year, invite the membership. We'll be on Capitol Hill 3 days this week, and immigration reform is definitely at the top of our talking points with our elected officials on both sides of the aisle.
And you're asking for what?
We need a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And a wall is not a solution.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, Mexico and Canada are number one and two buying of American products and services.
Wow.
Building a wall does not make any type of relationship foster. In fact, it hinders it. And it, quite frankly, if you look at the statistics, you have a net zero immigration happening. According to the Department of Justice, the lowest crime rate cities in the country are border cities. So...
that's going to surprise people, too.
It is. And that's the DOJ's numbers. Those aren't mine. And I mm-hmm. always tell people, you can look these up. There's public information. you know, I think we're smart. There's solutions. We need a solution. We have 10 to 11 million people here without proper papers. Mm-hmm. We need a workforce. Corporate America, small business is hurting right now. You know, 4 years ago, the number one concern from my constituency membership was healthcare costs. Now the number one is I cannot find talent.
Wow.
I have more jobs than I do have people that I can hire.
That's what we were talking with KU Chancellor Gerard in the first half of our show today. Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. And so we need a workforce. And there's a shortage of a workforce. So let's talk about real solutions that allow people to come out from the shadows and be more a part of our system.
And a lot of businesses don't, you know, a lot of Americans don't realize that that's what businesses are up against. And if certain remedies are put in place here, the impact on those businesses is going to be enormous. And it won't be good, right?
Exactly. It'll be a negative factor. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I discussed immigration quite a bit, and a lot of times, you know, with people on the other side in opposition. But here's what I tell them. We want the same thing. Mm-hmm. And what that is a solution. And what we haven't had for 20-some years is a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And
that lack of certainty has got to be an issue. Yeah,
it is. And people are afraid, and we don't need that. And what we do need is let's come to a compromise. And let's move forward and let's help industry, mm-hmm. let's help business. And more importantly, let's not divide families and let's make people feel safe that they can be a part of that American dream.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, Fong, one local issue that's been percolating for a while is this, the new airport terminal up at KCI, and how much of that work should be done by women and minority-owned contractors. Where does that issue stand with you guys? Do you support those policies, I'm sure? And tell me where that's standing.
Carlos and I were talking about this before we come in here.
Yeah,
I think there are many local issues that impact our constituents. So that's one of the things at the chamber we want to make sure we do, which is participating in those discussions.
Right.
Making sure those voices are heard. On that particular issue, you know, I didn't follow all around what are the different issues. But I think generally speaking, we want to make sure the policy change you know, there are certain things we couldn't necessarily take a stand as a chamber because it may impact a different sector of our chamber membership differently.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain things, especially if those impact small minority-owned businesses, we usually do voice opinion. Mm-hmm. And as I understand, you know, earlier this year that there was some discussion of those issues. But in addition to that, there are other strategic and planning issues around the city. Our chamber makes sure we have a participation in that. There are some planning committee, you know, about Overland Park, how the future community should be. We usually make sure we have a representative participating in those meetings and certain local economic development initiative.
Yeah.
You know, how that should involve or not involve our membership, or how does impact the local community. So we want to make sure we participate, and the Asian community has a voice in that.
Yeah. Well, I sure appreciate you both coming in to share your stories here today. And I'm so fascinated by the growth you're both seeing. Continued success. Keep going, okay? Thank you both very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That's Carlos Gomez, president of the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce of Greater Kansas City. Fong Shen, president of the Asian American Chamber of Commerce here in town. On Tuesday, could Kansas City become home to another major league sport? We'll learn about the efforts to expand hockey's footprint. Yes, hockey in the Midwest. Our show is produced by Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.